Constitution, and how much do you expect it will change?
Well, the thing is that since the beginning of the Constitutional Convention, the right wing and the great losers of that election have been doing a dirty campaign of fake news and promoting rejection of the new Constitution, even before it was written or even before we could see any of the articles. So they have a lot of advantage in that sense. They've been doing it for a long time, and now popular social movements and civil society is mobilizing for an approval of the new Constitution. And now we're seeing that with the draft in our hands, we're going to go to the streets to talk to people and communicate the actual changes. I think that those polls reflect the control that the mainstream media have on the political narrative in Chile. We see that they have been talking most of the information that is on social media and mainstream media is fake news. And now we're going to see what people think about the actual Constitution, the enshrining of social rights, of reproductive rights, of gender parity, of a democratic process, well, et cetera.
We have to leave it there. We thank you so much, Pablo Obafon, member of Chile's Solidaridad movement, anti-capitalist feminist group. We will post the Spanish conversation at democracynow.org. Happy birthday.
You're
to
listening
Eli
to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kbu.fm.
KBOO is in the middle of our annual spring membership drive. It's that time of year where KBOO is all abuzz, and we need you to come jive with our radio hive. Help us reach our $56,000 goal and keep the hive alive. Just go to kboo.fm/give or mail a check to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. And thank you.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, record turnout in a history-making election for Oregon, where the choice for governor in November will be between three women for the first time. Other notable gains included a first for a Latina and more women on the cusp of representing the state in Congress. And the pandemic's impact on children, taking a toll on their mental health. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, May 19th, 2022. I'm Annette Newell. So glad to have you with us. The number of ballots Oregon's elections officials have received so far is 75,000 more votes than have ever been cast in a midterm primary. As KBOO's Jeffrey Wade reports, that wasn't the only aspect of the election that was historic.
Three women are making history following a packed race for Oregon's next governor as we approach the 2022 gubernatorial election in November. Democrat Tina Kotek, Republican Christine Drazen, and unaffiliated candidate Betsy Johnson will be facing off competing for Oregon's highest office. It's highly unusual for Oregon to have a three-candidate gubernatorial race and is the first time that all three candidates are women. Only two of the state's 38 governors have been women, Barbara Roberts, who served from 1991 to 1995, and current governor Kate Brown, who took office in 2015. Brown did not run for this year's ballot due to term limitations. The three candidates on November's ballot are set to have their work cut out for them, all approaching the position with different paths. Kotek's nomination victory was announced Tuesday evening, while Drazen's won her nomination Wednesday afternoon. As a non-affiliated candidate, Johnson did not need to run in a primary race to make the fall ballot. The state has only once seen a non-affiliated governor in its history, with Julius L. Meyer, who served from 1931 to 1935. Though Oregon Oregon hasn't seen a GOP governor in 35 years, some political analysts are saying Republicans may have an opening following statewide discontent, largely due to Brown's COVID-19 closures and restrictions, as well as a potential vote split between Kotek, a progressive, and Johnson, a former Democratic senator. In Oregon, both Democratic voters and non-affiliated voters each amount to roughly 34% of the voting population, while Republicans account for about 25%. Which gubernatorial candidate that can collect the non-affiliated votes and win over undecided Democrats and Republicans both will likely play the key factor for the November victory. Johnson tweeted this week, quote, "The biggest change Oregon can make this year is putting people back in charge with an independent governor loyal only to Oregonians, not the political extremes," end quote. Kotek has served as Oregon's House Speaker for the last 9 years, the last of which have seen the state endure tumultuous times, and has the challenge to convince voters that she can improve the state without taking blame for its problems. In her victory speech on Tuesday, Kotek said, quote, "We're all going to work together to make sure we win, that a Democrat that I win in November, because frankly, there is just too much at stake," end quote. Drazen spoke with the press today, pushing that she is determined in leading the state in a different direction, saying, quote, "This is an opportunity for Oregonians to stand together and to stand up, regardless of party, and choose for our state to go in a new direction, and I am ready to lead our state to a stronger position and higher quality of life for all Oregonians," end quote. With the KBOO Evening News, I'm Jeffrey Wade.
Oregon's election was historic in many ways. I talked to Oregon State University history professor Dr. Chris Nichols about that. Okay, well, we got a postmortem to do on this crazy election. First of all, the blurry ballot barcodes delay with Oregon's House primary results. Is this our hanging Chad moment? Is Oregon the new Florida?
No, clearly not. Not at the level of, you know, national politics, national ignominious actions by state and county, very local clerks. But Clackamas County, you know, Barron County, not looking great right now from not having enough people there, people unwilling to take apparently extra time, overtime. Wide variety of what's been reported here. But I think the big takeaway here is we today expect almost instantaneous election results. And that's just not a reasonable expectation. We've seen this in national elections. We've seen this in the presidency. We've seen it in a number of other ways. And I think we all need to temper our expectations a bit, including the candidates themselves. I mean, did you see them tweeting, like, you know, back and forth, this sort of thing? We all need to relax and maybe be willing to take several days after an election before we take stock of what just happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we have the fate of a 7-term incumbent, Representative Kurt Schrader, hanging in the balance. Now, it still could. I mean, there's like, 29,000 outstanding ballots. It could still swing his way. You know, Clackamas is his home turf. It could, it could still go his way. But, you know, McLeod Skinner has a good chance here.
I think so. Yeah, I mean, I would say this. This is an evergreen comment. The math suggests at this point that McLeod Skinner has won, unless there's an unexpected skew of votes to Schrader. Her being up about 10,000 votes at this point with 54 or 55% of the votes in, even in a county that's skewing towards him, just indicates that he can't make it up, not that total number of votes. And so if that's true, and you know, that's just math, we actually have to count the ballots first. That's the most important thing in democracy. If that's true, that this is huge upset. Schrader being upset from the left, primaried from the left on the Democratic side, that we saw, you know, unions and we saw Democratic county local officials and party members fleeing from him, that he had sort of taken these stands which were more moderate or frankly like Manchin-esque Republican kinds of positions that the Democrats in the state of Oregon and in this district in particular did not like. And McLeod Skinner's done a really good job running in Eastern Oregon and elsewhere, proving that she can do kind of the classic campaigning that you need, retail politics, getting those endorsements. And this is a real success for her. It's a huge success. And though the district leans only slightly Democratic, you'd have to say it would be leaning towards a possible victory for her. Although had he come out ahead as an incumbent, he would have a better chance even than she would to win, again, in a district that leans only a little bit towards Democrats.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And she's trying to become the West Coast's first openly lesbian member of Congress. How historic would that be?
She is. And so is Tina Kotek, looking to be the first openly lesbian governor in the U.S. I mean, this is a really historic moment. I mean, just if you step back and think about the totality of the Oregon races and what we've seen now, we have three viable, professional, expert women now running for governor for the first time ever. You can find in the political record three women running for governor in different states. You've never had three who were viable candidates, all of them able to fundraise, all of them with real expertise in government, not running for the governorship and obscure kinds of parties, but actually having a serious chance. So this is a really historic election for the state of Oregon and for the country. I mean, from the governorship to the 5th district, 6th district is another example here too. Andrea Salinas, this is our new district in Oregon, upset Carrick Flynn, who was being endorsed by a ton of people. There was a lot of outside money coming in. And Salinas would be the first Latina woman member of Congress from Oregon. So, I mean, it's, you know, one, it's salient that these are women, and two, that these are people with different kinds of diverse life experiences and backgrounds and orientations that bring something to American politics that we haven't always seen. I brought in the governorship already. I couldn't help it.
It's true. It all kind of fits. It's like this, we have all these, all of a sudden this explosion of powerful, successful female candidates. Mm-hmm. And obviously there have been women who've run in the past who have been qualified, but this is the first time I think that we've seen so many of them be successful all at once, right? In Oregon history.
Very much. In Oregon history, for sure. And then you can also look back to the recent past across the U.S. We've seen, you know, 2018 and midterms in the 2020 election, lots of women elected to Congress as well, and to the state legislatures in places like Oregon. So you're really seeing a groundswell of women running for office and winning. And you know, the other way to put that is you're seeing the electorate more broadly want to elect women, which I think is significant, and people with different sexual orientations and, you know, non-traditional backgrounds. That's just pretty remarkable in the scope of U.S. history, where it's basically been a pretty homogenous set of people representing a public that's become much and much more heterogeneous.
Starbucks employees held a rally Wednesday intent on forming a union. One of the organizers said his Beaverton-based store was one of the first to apply for a union, and since then, more than 300 stores nationwide have followed suit. According to Starbucks Workers United, the group behind the unionization effort, at least 12 Portland metro area stores are trying to unionize, with some accusing the company of retaliating against the organizers. As of yesterday, 4 Portland locations confirmed voting in favor of unionizing, including Southeast 28th Avenue and Powell, Southwest 5th and Oak, Northeast 28th and Burnside, and Northeast Grand Avenue and Lloyd Boulevard. 3 other Portland-based stores have vote counts planned for June 3rd. Union organizer Quentin Conta said, quote, "You're safer in a union job. You're better taken care of. You have a voice and you're given respect in the workplace. Starbucks insists on calling its employees partners instead of workers, and we're just trying to reclaim that title." Responding to allegations of retaliation, a Starbucks spokesperson said, quote, "A partner's interest in a union does not exempt them from policies we have always held. We will continue to enforce our policies for all partners." The Seattle-based coffee company has announced enhanced worker benefits following record-breaking sales in its fiscal second quarter. However, Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz said earlier last month that it is against the law to offer those benefits to stores voting to unionize. The union says not offering those benefits is illegal. Starbucks Workers United says it has filed charges with the National Labor Relations Board, saying the company's threat to exclude new benefits from unionized stores is violating labor law. Inflation is eroding Washington caregivers' gains in pandemic hazard pay. Eric Tegedoff has the story.
At the start of the pandemic, at-home caregivers in Washington state saw their wages go up with a boost from hazard pay. 2 years later, inflation is erasing that pay bump. Wages actually have gone up for caregivers from $19 per hour in May 2020 to $19.26 today. But inflation means the purchasing power of their pay now is actually $17.46. Gwen Goodfellow is an at-home caregiver.
Having the hazard pay was really nice. It made us feel more comfortable to do like grocery orders instead of going to the store and allow us to be a little bit more protective. And then as time went on, the cost of things went up and it's not a bonus at this point.
Goodfellow's union SEIU 775 was instrumental in negotiating hazard pay for caregivers. Hazard pay was offered to essential workers who were in vulnerable positions as COVID-19 spread. Goodfellow looks after her mother and a friend, as well as taking care of her son. She says caregivers are struggling.
Good pay for caregivers is really important. I mean, we help seniors, we help people with disabilities. I know my situation isn't unique. I hate to say it, but sometimes it feels like I kind of almost chose poverty so that I could care for my family.
Goodfellow adds that benefits beyond pay are important as well, such as affordable health care, retirement, and paid time off that doesn't inhibit her ability to pay the bills. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The circus is back in town. That is, it will be somewhat soon. Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey will reopen in 2023 after a half-decade hiatus. With more on the story, here's KBOO's Josh Salem.
Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey is making a comeback, 5 years after shutting down its 3-ring circus. The company ended a 146-year run following intense criticism over its use of circus animals. Ticket sales declined as customers became conflicted about its treatment of those animals, and costly court battles led to the end of elephant acts in 2016. In the new production, audiences will become co-collaborators with the performers, creating what the company calls a different experience with every show. Auditions have now been conducted in Argentina, Mongolia, Ethiopia, France, and the United States, with more than 1,000 performers applying to join a 50-city North American tour starting in September 2023. International performances are also planned. The new show will not offer any animal acts. Chief Operating Officer Juliette Feld-Grossman told the Associated Press, quote, "For us, Ringling is about bringing the world's talents to people's hometowns. We are entertainment for everyone, and it's important that everyone who comes to the show finds something in someone that they can really connect and relate to," end quote. People for Ethical Treatment of Animals praised the animal-free revamp in a statement Wednesday. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In-Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather, mostly clear skies, down to 37. Tomorrow's weather, intervals of clouds and sunshine, a high near 65. The weekend's looking nice, up to the low 70s on Saturday and Sunday. Stay in history. On this date in 1864, President Abraham Lincoln wrote to Congress proposing that widows and children of soldiers should be given equal treatment regardless of race. Our quote of the day from Lincoln: "A house divided against itself cannot stand. I believe this government cannot endure permanently half slave and half free. I do not expect the Union to be dissolved. I do not expect the house to fall. But I do expect it will cease to be divided. It will become all one thing or all the other." The White House asks Congress for more pandemic support. The House passes a domestic terrorism bill. Kansas's Supreme Court upholds a new congressional map. And a House committee hears testimony on abortion access. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2022 Talks.
At some point, we're going to run out of the treatments we have. And without additional resources, we will find ourselves in the fall or winter with people getting infected and no treatments available for them because we will have run out.
White House COVID-19 Response Coordinator Dr. Ashish Jha urged Congress to allocate new funding to fight the pandemic. Cases nationwide are ticking steadily upward for the first time since the Omicron surge peaked in mid-January. Just days after a mass shooting in Buffalo left 10 dead and 3 injured, the House of Representatives Wednesday passed a new Domestic Terrorism Prevention Act. In a news conference, Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat of Illinois, said the bill aims to bolster America's response to the growing threat of white supremacy.
"Crucially, it would provide training and resources to assist state, local, and tribal law enforcement in addressing these threats."
Durbin says it would also combat alleged white supremacist infiltration of the uniformed services and federal law enforcement. The measure still needs to clear the Senate, where Majority Leader Chuck Schumer plans to push for a vote in the next week. President Joe Biden will meet with the leaders of Finland and Sweden to discuss the two countries' application to join NATO. CNN reports Turkey has raised an issue with the nation's bids, arguing they're sheltering members of the Kurdistan's Workers' Party, which has been labeled a terrorist organization by Turkey, the U.S., and the European Union. New applicants to NATO need unanimous approval, including Turkey's. But National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan told reporters Wednesday the administration is confident it can assuage the country's concerns.
Finland and Sweden are working directly with Turkey to do this, but we're also talking to the Turks to try to help facilitate.
The Kansas Supreme Court has upheld a Republican-drawn congressional redistricting plan, which Politico reports may edge out the state's only Democratic representative. The voting rights group and residents who brought the suit argued the new map violated the state's constitution and that it reduced the voting power of Black and Latino residents. The House Judiciary Committee held a hearing Wednesday on abortion access. Dr. Yashika Robinson, medical director of Alabama Women's Center, one of the state's last clinics providing abortion care, told lawmakers her clinic often cares for out-of-state patients.
Because of medically unnecessary abortion restrictions, I see patients forced to travel up to 12 hours from as far away as Louisiana, Florida, and now Texas because of the ripple effect of abortion bans, stigma, and targeted harassment, all leading to other providers being forced to shut their doors.
The hearing comes as the U.S. Supreme Court is likely to overturn Roe v. Wade, the landmark case guaranteeing the right to an abortion, in the coming months. Abortion is still legal across the country until the Supreme Court hands down a final decision. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Jonah Chester.
An online discussion on Friday will connect the idea of death anxiety to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, especially for some people in the Pacific Northwest. Eric Tegedoff reports.
What is the link between anxiety about death and Russian President Vladimir Putin's decision to invade Ukraine? A Seattle-based organization is hosting a webinar on Friday to discuss the connection. The Ernest Becker Foundation seeks to advance understanding of its namesake's Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Denial of Death. Sheldon Solomon is a psychology professor at Skidmore College and a panelist on the webinar. He says Becker's ideas about terror management theory put forth that humans manage their fear of death by embracing cultural worldviews to give life meaning. Solomon says it convinces us we're eligible for immortality, sometimes literally with ideas of heaven or afterlives.
Or symbolically, just the idea that you may not be here forever, but some indication of your existence will persist nonetheless, maybe by having kids or amassing a great fortune or being part of a great state or nation.
Solomon argues that whether we're aware of it or not, we're highly motivated to maintain faith in our cultural beliefs since they give value to our lives as individuals, and we'll respond defensively and reflexively when our cultural beliefs or self-esteem is threatened. Enter Vladimir Putin. Solomon says Putin has been motivated since his days as a KGB agent when the Soviet Union collapsed to bring back the golden age of the USSR, thus giving him a path towards symbolic immortality. He says Putin is an example of a toxic leader who might experience overwhelming waves of death anxiety.
The superficial veneer of self-confidence is really a mask for massive insecurity, a sense of always possibly being humiliated that in turn fosters, whether he's aware of it or not, a constant sense of self-loathing.
Michael McPherson is executive director of the South Seattle Emerald and is hosting the webinar. He's also a Gulf War veteran and member of Veterans for Peace.
Death anxiety goes a long way, at least in helping provide some understanding of why we put up with this terrible thing that we call war.
Solomon notes that the pandemic has been a pervasive reminder of our mortality and could be fueling the rise of authoritarianism around the globe as people cling tighter to their beliefs. But he says a better understanding of death anxiety could play a role in ratcheting down these forces.
One way, and it may be the only way, that we can overcome those very destructive tendencies is to go to great lengths to remind ourselves that as human beings, we have a whole lot more in common than we are different.
Friday's webinar starts at 10 a.m., and people can register for it at the Ernest Becker Foundation's website. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Across the nation, alarms are going off about the pandemic's effect on kids' mental well-being. Groups that provide support and guidance say there are things parents, educators, and policymakers can do to help the situation. Mike Moen reports.
As the school year winds down, education leaders are shedding light on increased mental health demands among students, including thoughts of suicide. Various organizations in Iowa are calling attention to the issue during Mental Health Awareness Month. Lisa Couchet of the trauma healing group Iowa ACEs 360 says concerns were building prior to the pandemic, but adds the crisis has added layers of mental health issues for children and adolescents. She says what's happening now shatters the myth that kids are born resilient, especially when adults in their lives feel extra stress simultaneously.
We want to believe kids are born resilient, but we have such a responsibility of adults to help cultivate that and model that, and it's really hard to do when we're in crisis ourselves.
According to new CDC data, 44% of U.S. high school students recently reported persistently feeling sad or hopeless in the past year, and nearly 20% had seriously considered attempting suicide. Last month, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommended screening for anxiety in youth between the ages of 8 and 18. And while school counselors are responding to more referrals, there are calls to enhance training for all staff to help these students. Those suggestions coincide with gaps in locating enough providers who can help a child away from campus. Erin Drennan of the United Way of Central Iowa says Iowa's children's behavioral system is feeling the impact of the workforce shortage.
How do we recruit enough mental health professionals, you know, to go into school, to go into these professions, to be able to serve youth and adults?
The Coalition to Advance Mental Health in Iowa for Kids recommends actions such as student loan forgiveness and maintaining telehealth flexibilities. Julia Webb of NAMI Iowa says parents and educators can be proactive by intervening when warning signs pop up.
If you're seeing a young person isolating themselves, not taking joy in the things that they previously found happiness in, ending relationships with friends, not wanting to interact with friends.
For crisis situations, signs include expressing great shame and plans that point to ending their life. Mike Moen, Iowa News Service.
Next week, Indiana could become the latest state to pass a bill banning transgender girls from school supports. An LGBTQ organization is offering counseling and mental health services for trans kids and teens as lawmakers push through a bill many consider transphobic. And according to the Human Rights Campaign, from January through early May 2021, lawmakers introduced more than 250 anti-LGBTQ bills. Jonah Chester has more on the story.
Earlier this spring, Republican Governor Eric Holcomb vetoed a GOP-authored bill banning transgender girls from school sports. Now, Holcomb's own party is poised to override that veto and force the bill into law next week. Chris Paulson with the Indiana Youth Group says her organization has resources for transgender teens who may be facing mental health difficulties because of the bill and its surrounding political rhetoric. That includes one-on-one counseling and peer-to-peer support groups.
They can choose which group they feel comfortable in. So we have a trans and non-binary discussion group. We have a queer and trans people of color group. And then there's groups that just allow youth to relax and feel good about themselves.
Republican leaders say they'll use next Tuesday's technical corrections day to override Holcomb's veto. According to its authors, the bill aims to guarantee fair play in school sports. In his veto message, Holcomb pushed back against that assertion, writing essentially that the bill was attempting to address a non-existent issue and could open the state to lawsuits. Indiana's bill is part of a nationwide wave of such measures, as 16 states have enacted laws banning trans students from sports. Paulson points to data from the Trevor Project that indicates that even the introduction of such bills can have serious impacts on trans kids' mental health.
Statistics say that 85% of trans and non-binary teens will be negatively impacted by just the bill being heard. And we're seeing that. And we're trying to support those youth by letting them know that they are valued and their identities are real. And we see them as they are.
While the Indiana Youth Group is based in Indianapolis, Paulson says the organization provides remote support to students across the state via its virtual IYG program. For the Indiana News Service, I'm Jonah Chester.
During Wildfire Awareness Month this May, state officials are encouraging Colorado residents to create evacuation plans now and to take steps to mitigate fire risks on their property. Fire mitigation assistance is available through a program called Wildfire Partners. As Eric Galatis reports, as many as 80% of the homes lost to wildland fires could have been saved if their owners had followed a few simple fire-safe practices.
May is Wildfire Awareness Month, and state officials are encouraging Coloradans to get up to speed on prevention and emergency exit strategies if evacuation notices are issued. Rocco Snart with the Colorado Division of Fire Prevention and Control says it's never too early to prepare. Make a list of all the things you need to take with you, including a week's worth of prescription medicines. Next, find a place you can go and make plans to get there. He says you don't want to be in a rush when you leave your house.
You want to try to make that on your own terms so that you can make sure that you've collected everything that you need. If you needed a walker and you needed to get it in the vehicle, or if you needed to arrange to get a ride to come and pick you up, the earlier you can work on those things, the better.
Snart says make sure your insurance policies and personal identification documents are up to date and make copies for your emergency travel kit, which should also include N95 masks to protect yourself from smoke inhalation. A complete checklist for disaster preparedness is available at ready.gov. The group Wildfire Partners works with Mile High Youth Corps in Denver to provide wildfire mitigation services at no cost to older residents. Snart says even small steps can help. Make sure trees and plants are well hydrated, and if you live near open spaces, reduce vegetation to create a buffer around your house.
Make sure that, you know, any deck materials are taken care of and not splintered, right? I mean, a deck with, you know, splintered wood and wood that's breaking down looks like a campfire for embers, right?
Climate change is projected to create longer wildfire seasons in years ahead, with fires becoming more frequent and intense. Snart says this new reality can lead to a sense of denial, but he encourages everyone to take time to be prepared.
That's not going to happen in my neighborhood. That's not going to happen in my subdivision. And the reality of it is it can happen anywhere, you know, in the Front Range, in the mountains, wherever there's fuels and homes next to one another.
This is Eric Galatis reporting for the Colorado News Connection.
A new probe into the most horrific residential school reports in Canada. Prince Charles asked for a royal apology over residential schools during his visit to Canada. A trial starts for two white men accused of shooting two hunters. The feds plan to return 12 acres to the Leech Lake Band in Minnesota after mistakenly selling them 75 years ago. And Denver University is the latest to offer free tuition to Native students with a Colorado connection. With these stories and more, here's today's edition of National Native News.
A First Nation in Western Canada says it's looking into the deaths of more than 200 children who never came home from a residential school. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, one researcher calls the former school